I love them. I don't care what anybody thinks. I love the Beatles for them, and I'll always love them. Even when I'm 105 and an old grandmother, I'll love them.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the She Loves You podcast, the podcast where we talk about the incredible women in the Beatles' lives, everyone from the wives, the girlfriends, the friends, the colleagues, the alleged affairs, but especially the fans. I am so happy to bring you guys this episode today. I have had great opportunities with this podcast to talk to some great people so far. I've had a couple guests a little bit, but you know, it's been great to talk to everybody. But I think the best thing about doing this podcast is that I got to talk to people that were actually there in history and got to witness, you know, these men, you know, produce some of the greatest music of all time and lived through their, you know, through the excitement of it all. And, you know, especially when we think about the Beatles, we think about Beatlemania and how insane it all was. And I wish I had a time machine or some sort of teleport machine to be, you know, 15 years old then or 16 years old, because I would have been, you know, president of the John Lennon fan club. I know that much, definitely. So today, guys, I'm so happy to introduce my next guest. She was the president of the Victor Spinetti fan club. And if you all remember who Victor Spinetti is, he was in A Hard Day's Night and Help and was really, really great friends with all of the Beatles throughout their lives. And she is a self-proclaimed Beatle maniac and has been for the past, you know, decades now. And she has written an incredible, incredible book called Diary of a Beatle Maniac. And I'm so, so honored to welcome Patricia Gayo Steinman. Hi, Patricia. It's so good to speak to you today.
It's so good to speak to you and to meet you for the second time. That's very nice.
Yes, because we did meet at the Fest in 2019, yes. And it's where I got her incredible book, which I recommend everybody go out and read because it's amazing. It's amazing. But yeah, it's so great to have you on here. And, you know, I'm just honored to be able to speak to a first generation Beatles fan, you know, ever.
Thank you, Natalia. I appreciate that. Way back then, we never thought of ourselves as anything like a first-generation Beatle fan, but nice after all these years to get recognized, let's put it that way.
Definitely. I mean, you girls deserve it. You kind of paved the way for everybody to be Beatles fans in a way. As I mentioned, I would have totally been the president of the John Lennon fan club back in the day, just because, you know, I love you girls for doing all that. And also just the Victor Spinetti fan club. What a concept. Yeah. Just so, so great. I loved that. So you've written this incredible book called Diary of a Beatle Maniac, where you essentially published your diaries that you wrote from the time you were about 13 onward,
right?
In the 60s, which, you know, I've always thought, like, oh my gosh, publishing my diary is so personal. I don't know if I could have done that. So what besides your love for the Beatles, obviously, what made you want to write or publish your diaries? What made you want to tell this story?
Well, actually, it came about in a very funny way. Back in 1974, which was 10 years after Beatlemania hit in the States, I was a young journalist, fresh out of college a couple of years, and we had a Sunday magazine in our newspaper. I belonged to a big staff on a metropolitan paper in Philadelphia called the Philadelphia Evening and Sunday Bulletin. Now, I had an idea for my Sunday editor to do a story called 10 Years After Beatlemania. And I did. I wrote this story, and it was interesting. And I took it from my diary and other things I had around the house. And the kernel was in the back of my brain right then that, you know, this might make a nice book someday, you know, a memoir. Although even 10 years after Beatlemania, nobody knew that it was going to still be around, you know, 50, 60 years later. So that was actually the idea. And of course, the diary, which started when I was 12 or 13, had information, a lot of information about other things, but it did have Beatlemania in it. So that helped me along. And I didn't mind putting, I didn't have that personal information as a 12-year-old back then. Right. So it was kind of fun to use the diary. And also I had kept Beatles scrapbooks, which all the girls did. And I still have mine. They're crumbling, but I still have them. And I did have something that many kids did then was besides scrapbooks, we had pen pals from England who send us information and that kind of thing. And I was very lucky in one way. I'd love to write even when I was in grade school. So when the Beatles were coming to Philly the first time in 1964 in September, about a month before, I contact the editor of a small, I was 14. So I contacted the editor of a very small little neighborhood newspaper in my neighborhood to ask if I could have a press pass to see the Beatles. And of course she said, we're such a tiny newspaper, we don't get anything. But she said, you sound interesting. Would you like to write a column for us about teenagers in the neighborhood? And of course they didn't pay me for it, but I wound up writing this column, Teen to Teen, with a girlfriend of mine, Diane. We alternated. I wrote it until way into college. So, and believe me, it had a lot of information about the Beatles, the British invasion groups, actually fashion, teenage fashion, all kinds of teenage culture stuff. I kept every one of those columns that I have in another scrapbook, and I used that for the research for the book as well.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, that you've accomplished so much. I don't think at 15 or 16 I would have been able to do any of that. I mean, that's insane. But I guess it goes to show the love of the Beatles makes you do like insane things, you know what I mean?
Figure in those days, and I will talk about this probably, there was no internet to keep you company, right? And to help you along. We got all of our news from the radio stations that, you know, and the teenage kind of based radio stations in the big cities. So we would hear all the news and stuff that was going on. So it was a different world, you know, for, we kept busy in different ways than you guys today. So
definitely. And that's, I think, I mean, I love me and my technology. You know, I think technology has afforded us the ability to communicate with people. And I think that's the one good thing I think about technology. Yeah. But I will say, I think it is so nice that back in the day, you were getting all this information very slowly and you were, you know, kind of absorbing it all as it came. And it's just, it's amazing. And I always think about that, particularly with Beatles history and being a Beatles fan. There was so much change in the span of, 6 years that they were together, 7 years, that it was all so new. And it, like, it just must have blown everybody's mind at that point, you know, how 64 was very different from 66, you know, like 66 very different from 69, you know, so it's incredible, really.
Yeah,
definitely.
And the incredible part of it is the young Beatlemaniacs, the first generation, say we were 14, I was 14 when it all started. So by the time it was dying, going its course, at when they were breaking up, I was in college.
That's
so
incredible.
We were different people, women, young women, from when, if we were 14 or 13, from when it started to when it was finishing. You know, at college we were, you know, had boyfriends, we were interested in different things, but the love of the Beatles was still there, but it was very different than the 1964 love.
Definitely. You essentially grew up with them is kind of the quote I'm hearing a lot from old, you know, younger or you know, first generation fans is like, we grew up with them, you know,
it's sort of how
I also think about the previous generation grew up with like Elvis or, you know, like even Frank Sinatra. It's like, you guys grew up with the Beatles.
Yep.
And it's just,
that's true.
That's why I say you guys are the luckiest lot because you got them first, you know, definitely.
We did. We were really, we didn't know that we were lucky because when it happened, we had no idea that, you know, almost 60 years later, you just, you know, look at TV or you turn the computer on and there's all Beatle news. I mean, it's amazing. And it's hot and it's going to stay hot, I believe. So
definitely.
It's kind of funny. And sometimes my friends and I, you know, look at one another, my first generation friends say, boy, we're really relics, aren't we? You know, we've been through it, you know,
yeah.
But it's fun. It's been a fun ride, and it's still fun, which is nice.
Definitely. Something I loved about your book in particular is because these are diaries and these are kind of like your very intimate thoughts about everything that was going on then, I just loved witnessing a young girl kind of experience life in this way. And, you know, you put your real feelings out there. Like you in the beginning, at least, you were always about like, you were kind of like every other young teenage girl, very, you know, self-esteem issues and sort of the idea that I'm not pretty enough. You know, am I going to do something with my life? I think that was so powerful because, you know, you could have just gone on about the Beatles and been like, Paul's hair looks really nice today. But, you know, you put those really deep feelings, and I really appreciated that because I think that's kind of the experience of every young teenage girl is, you know, we feel things so intensely. And I remember being that way, you know. I remember being 14, 15 and being like, oh my gosh, you know, is anyone ever going to like me? You know, I feel so terrible about myself. So I really loved that aspect about the book, you know, beyond the Beatles, that it was just also wonderful to see the story of a young girl kind of come into her own. And that was just beautiful, beautiful. I loved it.
Well, thank you. It was an interesting time, though, because when I look back at the diaries, and of course, there was a lot of things I forgot, and I look back at it, and I thought, boy, I really was, you know, sort of into my little shell, you know, and even when I loved Paul so much, I said, oh, he could never love me. I'm so ugly. And he's got such beautiful Jane Asher and all this kind of stuff. And that's actually how I felt. But it came out as in the words of a 14-year-old, or and that it needed to be said. And I wasn't embarrassed putting it in there because I think a lot, as I said, a lot of young girls, even your generation, go through the same thing today. So it's a lot of angst, but you know, you need to blossom and break out of the shell. So,
absolutely. And you definitely did. And I think like you being able to find the Beatles and have this sort of passion, it really, you found yourself, I think. And that's like the most beautiful thing about like the whole book is just reading you finding yourself in general. So I loved that part of the book.
Thank you.
And I would say I just love the whole book in general because it's just so wonderful.
Oh, thanks.
I've always said, thank God that you can still, like, there are still first generation fans that can publish all of this because we, you know, we as the older fans don't know what it was like, and we get a taste of what it was like with these books. So we're very thankful for that.
Well, thank you. That's true. And there's actually been a really good book that was just published. I'm sure you know about it. It's an American, she is a professor of women's studies, and she has written a book called, Women and the Beatles.
Yes.
And she interviewed me, and she interviewed Pat, and she interviewed Marty and a lot of other first generations to find out how, which is very interesting, how the Beatles kind of pushed us into our adult careers and how it helped us become adults as women in that generation.
Definitely.
And, you know, because you realize the 60s, the beginning of the 60s, there was no women's liberation. Right. You know, it really kind of trickled in the beginning of the 70s, the very end of the 60s. So we were the right age for the women's liberation movement, which happened a couple years later. But the Beatles spearheaded that in a lot of ways because we were out in public as fan club presidents, you know, writing columns, all kinds of things. So that did help spearhead the women's liberation movement that came right after as we grew up. You know, it was interesting.
Absolutely. So. And that's, I would love to have her on the show. Maybe one day we'll see about that. Just because I've always said that the Beatles were really the first sort of look into feminism for a lot of young girls at that time, because it was the first time I think, you know, young girls were finally saying, oh, I like rock and roll and I'm going to listen to it and I'm going to wear, you know, dresses that go above my knees and, you know, my parents can't tell me yes or no, you know? So that was the first time. Yeah. And it's so funny that like in your book as well, you talk about like your parents saying like, no, you know, and other parents, you know, your friends' parents just saying, no, you know, we don't want, you know, these poor British men corrupting you girls, you know. It's like, it's just so funny to me now looking back, but you know, at the time that's how it was, you know. It was very restricted and it was very just like, you know, you had to sort of follow what your parents said, and that was the reality. But the Beatles were just like breaking the chains finally. It was like, nope, we're gonna love these guys and do what we
want.
We're
gonna do what we want. And it's exactly how it was. And I went to a very strict Catholic girls' school for high school, and the nuns frowned on anything Beatle. you know, I had made my own little Beatle calendar for inside my locker, you know. And the nun came down the aisle at the locker aisle, and she ripped it off the, right off my door. And then I had my Beatle bubblegum cards taken by my English nun, because I was passing them around in the aisle. So, but she gave them back. So I still have my 108 Beatle bubblegum cards. But you know, there was this restrictive feeling because girls, you know, didn't have a voice back then.
Right, absolutely.
And maybe this is one of the first times when teenage girls, except for Elvis, I guess, but you know, that girls had more of a voice to say, well, I'm going to wear short dresses, and I'm going to take the train from Philly to New York to Shea Stadium at age 15.
Yeah.
Whoa, that kind of stuff. And I do have in the book one part where I can't remember because it's a long time ago, but my parents wouldn't let me go up to New York once to see Victor. I had gone up to see him when he was in a play up there a couple times, but this one time they wouldn't let me go. And I was so angry, and I can't remember the reason, you know, but I'm thinking, yeah, we were breaking out in different ways, you
Definitely.
Know, and going to college for the first, you have to remember, we were really the first generation that college went down to blue collar girls. It hadn't before that. So, you know, we got good grades, and, you know, we knew what we wanted, which the Beatles helped in many ways too, to push us. And also, and I did bring this up somewhere, that they pushed us out to learn things. For example, if you were a fan club president or vice president, you had to learn about administration skills and all kinds of stuff, which helped us as adults too, to learn
Definitely.
How to work in an office and stuff. So that's
Definitely.
Fun.
That was something I always wondered about. And we'll talk about this when I ask you more about the fan clubs and stuff, but it's interesting how you guys were so young, but you had to learn how to administer, and you had to learn how to, like, you know, because it's not just you, it's people depending on you, fan club, you know, people. And you know, that's just so interesting. You know, again, I don't know if I could have done all that at like 15, 16 years old. I would have been just, you know, like, what? But that's amazing.
And you know, something, we were so excited and happy that it just pushed us on.
Definitely.
You know, we kept trying things, and like with the fan clubs, we didn't know what we were doing, but you know, we just sometimes we had help from our parents. Pat had a lot of help from her parents because she had a big fan club for George. But I mean, it just kind of pushed us to do things, and I'm glad it did, because I'm a different person today because of it. I know that. So
that's wonderful. So take us back to the beginning. When was the first time you discovered the Beatles, and, you know, how did you feel in that moment?
Okay, well, the very first time I saw them was actually on the Jack Parr show, which was a Friday night entertainment show he was very, a commentator and a little bit of a comedian. He had gone to England to tape something else, part of his show, and he actually saw the Beatles were so popular. This was, it aired in January 1964, about a month before the Ed Sullivan show. So what he did on his show is he had a little black and white segment of the Beatles performing somewhere in some city, I'm not sure where. And then he showed that, and that was the first time they were on American TV.
Okay.
And about the same time, the Sunday Bulletin, the newspaper, had a little article in their Sunday magazine about the Beatles, and it was black and white pictures of this famous group from England. So I actually saw that, I heard about them, and I saw them with my own eyes twice. Before Ed Sullivan in February. So that was how it all started. When we saw them on Ed Sullivan, which was Sunday night, we all picked our favorite Beatle right then. That's when we did it. We did it.
I was about to ask you that, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I've been Paul's girl now for like 57 years, I guess. It's so funny. I got all kinds of false stuff. And what happened was that when we came back to school on Monday, that was a Sunday night with Ed Sullivan, we kind of started banding together in little groups who liked the Beatles. Now, there were a lot of girls who didn't give a hoot. Okay, that's fine. But we saw who liked the Beatles, and we kind of banded together and became buddies. And I call them now Beatle Buddy groups. We didn't call them that back then. So my big Beatle Buddy group consisted of the four of us. And then I was also a Beatle Buddy with another girl who was an old friend of mine from kindergarten. So I actually was in two little groups, which is very interesting. So from there on, it blossomed. You know, we bought Beatle memorabilia, which we didn't call memorabilia. It was Beatle junk. Our parents called it Beatle junk. We called it Beatle stuff. And we weren't, you know, rich. So basically, at the beginning, all it was Beatle buttons and bubblegum cards and John Lennon caps. We love those things. And that kind of stuff. I had a pair of Beatle sneakers that I wore out. That was later on in the summer. So that's how it went. And then we, you know, we would get together at somebody's house, and my friend Diane had Beatle pictures all over her walls and ceiling in her bedroom. And we'd sit there and we'd talk about the Beatles. And of course, in those days, as I said, the only news we got was from the radio, from teenage magazines that were quite popular back then, like 16 Magazine, Teen Scene Magazine. And also, we would get, that was about, and from pen pals. So they were the three ways we would really hear about it. And newspapers did write little articles about them. I cut everyone out. I still have them. So that's how we started, really. And it just got more intense as it went on, you know, because the Beatles were coming to Philadelphia in September 64. So we all had to, you know, kind of go one notch up and do things like plan to meet them in a hotel. We had a plan, which didn't work out, but we did that. I typed that whole plan up. It was Beatles plan. And the first concert was actually a real high point for us, which was the beginning of September. I think it was September 2nd, 64 at Philadelphia Convention Hall. I was lucky enough to get tickets. Tickets were really hard to come by. But my cousin and my uncle were good friends with the guy who owned the biggest record store in Philadelphia.
I remember reading that, and I was like, oh, she snagged it, because she knew what to do.
Two tickets. I got two tickets for me and my girlfriend, Kathy. And we did go, you know, we were so fortunate to be able to go. But that concert was in a convention center. You couldn't hear anything. We were on wooden chairs on the, you know, the flat area that of the convention center. So that was very hard for us to see or hear. And girls were standing on top of these rickety wooden, you know, folding chairs, falling over. So my girlfriend actually ripped a hole in her knee.
Oh, no.
From falling. There was just, it was just a weird night, but we still were happy we were there, but unlike the later concerts, I saw them three times in person, but the later two concerts at Shea and in Philly were in the big sports stadiums. So you could at least hear them on the loudspeakers, and you could see them looking like little tiny ants, but you could see them and hear them. So
you were there, and that's the point. You know, at the end of the day, you were there, you witnessed them. But you know, that's great, because I know a lot of fans didn't even get to see them more than once. So the fact that you got three times, that's incredible in itself. And I loved that part in the book, and I think it's probably my favorite part of all these sort of like first generation fans experiences. They all make a plan. They make a plan to meet them at the hotel. It's always the same thing. And sometimes it's successful, and other times it's just a nightmare, you know?
This plan was so offbeat and crazy. And I have the original type 2 pages that typed up. I mean, we were going to get dressed up in our Sunday best and get a room at the really posh, you know, hotel where they were supposed to be staying. And like my mother would let me stay at a hotel, you know, in Philadelphia, like, duh, I was 14 or 15. So it was just funny. We just had all these plans and schemes.
Yeah.
And of course, most of them didn't work out. And as we got older, I actually put in my diary, you know, like, it never works out. What am I doing this for? I'm getting older. What am I doing this for? You know?
Yeah, no, but, definitely. I do commend the people that do make it work though, because I've read some Beatle testimonies and they're like, we got in and, you know, Paul shook my hand and I'm like, I am amazed at that, you know, because I know I would have not been able to do that. Like my plan would have fumbled completely.
I know
back in the day, correct me if I'm wrong, but like radio DJs would kind of announce, oh, and the Beatles are going to be staying at the Warwick or, you know, the Hilton.
Yes.
So that's, I'm assuming how bands would find out and they would just, you know, go wild with that.
I tell you, the disc jockeys were the, you know, the gurus of their time because they told us, you know, everything they would find out, they would tell us, and it would lead to a chase or whatever. Or I remember the morning that Ringo got his tonsils out, and my girlfriend Kathy was a huge Ringo fan, and she was very upset. But how do we find out that morning? On the radio before we went to school, from the disc jockey, Highlit on the WIBG. So we got to school, we all know the news. That's how we found out early in the morning. So it was a jungle drums from the disc jockeys who would spur these things on. And sometimes they would get backlash for it. I mean, one time I remember about the Beatle tickets, they were selling Beatle tickets over at convention hall, you know, 4 or 5 months before the concert. And they announced it on WIBG. And they said, oh, girls, they're going to be sold between like, you know, 12 and 2. Well, the girls had to be at school that day and they played hooky. And the disc jockey got in trouble for that because all these girls were in line waiting for tickets when they should be at school.
Absolutely. So. But again, you know, we'll do anything for the Beatles, which is hilarious in itself.
True.
And it's, I don't know, again, like that's something that can never be like lived again, you know, those moments of you know, pure chaos.
No.
But, you know, props to the DJs for finding out that information, because I know that, you know, I'm sure Brian Epstein and everybody kept it pretty hidden, you know. Obviously you come to think of, if the Beatles are coming into town, they're going to stay at the best hotel in the city, but you know, sometimes they were pretty good at, you know, covering up where they were actually staying. But good for the radio DJs, that's, you know, props to them being able to deliver it to you guys, because, you know, it was your only source of information.
It was the only immediate source of information. Right. I mean, we would get other information, but they were so immediate, you know. Yeah. So we would get, and then I mean, the day of the first concert at Convention Hall, I wanted to see them come in. So my girlfriend Kathy and I went around 8 o'clock in the morning to Convention Hall, and we slipped out in the back of Convention Hall to wait. And we went behind some big pillars. Of course, that lasted maybe 4 or 5 hours. So we had to go to the bathroom. So we came out, and lo and behold, there were hundreds of girls and police and barricades. Oh, it was amazing. So we couldn't get back again, but it just goes to show that, you know, it was such a popular thing to do, and people knew where they were going to be and they wanted to see them when they came to town. And of course, they came in by some kind of truck, and they actually left the same evening by truck. They did not even stay at a hotel in Philadelphia.
Wow.
So, you know, so
I mean, best way to sneak out of there, I think. And you mentioned, of course, you've been mentioning your friends, your friend groups that were, you know, so dedicated. That must have been great to have people that you could relate to that much, because, you know, I know sometimes my Beatle obsession gets me weird looks, not because they don't like the Beatles themselves, but because they're like, why are you so obsessed with them? So
they don't understand. Absolutely. They're the non-believers.
Absolutely. So you know, it must've been great that you had, you know, like your friend Kathy and everybody else, just to kind of, you know, love them as much as you do.
The funny thing is that we were so close to our little Beatle buddy groups that when each Beatle got married, for example, the first one that got married, of course, I guess was, Ringo, I guess. And my girlfriend, Kathy, was deathly in love with Ringo. Aww. So she came to school that day with tears in her eyes in a state of shock, you know? So we all cuddled around her, the little Beatle buddies, and helped her all day. And the same thing when George married Patty, our friend Joanne did the same thing. We were at school. That was a weekend. And I remember we said, we have to take care of Joanne this weekend, you know, because yep. They were like almost devastated. Suicidal, you know?
Yeah. It was
sad. They were ours and we didn't want any other Beatle ladies taking them over. So that was a funny thing actually, because we had this strange thing about the Beatle girlfriends and the Beatle wives.
I was about to ask you that. Yeah. How was your general? I mean, I got a sense in the book that Miss Jane Asher was not your favorite person in the world.
No. I call her Asher Smasher. That was my nickname. And I did not like her. And I think in the book, I did bring this point out that I think it was after they got engaged or whatever. I was at lunch at my school, which was a strict Catholic high school, girls' high school. And we decided to, after Help came out. So we decided to have a sacrifice of Jane Asher with a clay Jane Asher doll. So my girlfriend made this little clay doll with the corn cob kind of little hands. And at our table where we're having lunch, we sacrificed Jane Asher. And of course, nuns are walking around the lunchroom, you know, just, you know, patrolling. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, if we would have been caught with that one, you know, where we sacrificed Jane Asher during lunch period. And it really made me feel sad years later, because I got to know Peter Asher through Beatle Fest and my friend who is very good friends with him. And I always said to her, I'm so embarrassed about this part in the book, you know, if he happens to read it, because, you know, I'm hating on his sister, you know, and the whole thing, because I was 14 or 15. But we loved Cynthia, because Cynthia was already there. She was the mother of John's child. She had a very soft demeanor. I mean, she just was loved by a lot of Beatle women, you know, fans.
I can get the sort of general sense of that, you know, in every sort of Beatle fan book I've read, they're like, oh, and Cynthia was great. We loved Cynthia, which is so funny, because she's, I mean, I don't know if you'll listen to the podcast, but you'll see that Cynthia is my favorite Beatle girl and has always been my favorite Beatle girl. And I actually run an Instagram page dedicated to Cynthia, if you would love to follow it. So so that's great to hear that she was so loved, because I know a lot of John girls could get passionate, but it's great that she was so like universally loved in that way. It's wonderful.
She was like, you know, a Mother Mary figure for us. We really loved Cynthia. And, you know, we would see pictures of the Beatle wife and the Beatle girlfriends in newspapers and stuff and magazines. So we got to know Patty and we got to know Jane and Maureen, and not Maureen as many as the other ones. She had a bit of a low profile because she wasn't an actress and she wasn't a model, but we sure got to know Patty, and we tried to, you know, look and see what they wore. And we would kind of mimic stuff. The first few months, no, we couldn't in the States. But after that, we were getting ripoffs of Mary Quant dresses, And so we go to the big department stores, and we were able to buy some of that stuff. And then, you know, hike our skirts up short the way they were, you know, wearing shorter
absolutely
skirts and dresses. And then the one funny thing was Patty Boyd was a real fan, and I think Jane was too, of white stockings, white tights, got to be very popular in the British area of fashion. It wasn't popular in Philadelphia. I had to go to the department store that summer and buy nursing stockings.
Oh my goodness. Until
white stockings became a fad, which was maybe 6 or 8 months later, and you could find them in the stores. But no, my first pair was nursing stockings. and I remember wearing them in Center City, Philadelphia, with a strappy shoe and a mini dress. And it was in the summer. And nobody had white stockings. I remember this young businessman turning to me and saying, oh, provocative, you know, like, oh my goodness, because nobody wore those. But we tried to mimic what the Beatle girlfriends and wife wore. And it just was, you know, something that kept us closer to everybody, you know.
Absolutely. That's amazing. I mean, I loved the 60s style. And every time I see like any pictures of the Beatles and their girlfriends or wives or whatever, I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys got to, you know, actually wear those, and you wouldn't, you know, be seen as looked at weird. Cause every time I try to wear, you know, 60s dresses, I get looks, you know, I'm like, you know, yes.
I loved my 60s clothes. And I took pictures of not everything, but I took pictures of me wearing my 60s clothes. And I put that on my website a lot, you know, this is what we wore and how we wore it. I've talked about fashion a couple times because, you know, there was not that we would go, we weren't rich kids. We were neighborhood kids. So we couldn't go out and buy the real stuff, like the real Mary Quant stuff, but we would go out and buy ripoffs and wear the stockings and the strappy shoes and of course grow our hair and the bangs, and the hair had to be long. And, I remember my mother saying to me, you have to get a haircut, because I had some pimples on my face and she thought the long hair was. So she dragged me to the hairdresser and I got a haircut, and I cried for months. Oh. I mean, you know, I want my long hair back, you know, just like the Beatle girlfriends, you know.
Yeah, so of course.
It was very close to the heart, believe me.
And it's interesting that, like, you know, you were obviously a little bit envious of these women, of course, because they had the hearts of our Beatles. But at the same time, you definitely loved the way that they dressed, and you loved the way that they, you know, because it was, you know, I could just imagine Patty at that point, you know, just seeing pictures of her. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, of course.
Well, she was a model, and she knew how to dress, and so did Jane. I mean, and Maureen, they all had that style, and Cynthia. And, you know, it just was so amazing to see them. And, you know, yes, we did chase them. We thought, oh, wow, he's going to be mine, you know. But then I do write in the book, and I did write in the article, like, it was the chase that thrilled us. If we would have caught one, what the heck would we have done with them? We were 14.
We
in those days. It's like, that's interesting. You know, you're chasing after a beetle at age 14, but it was a chase, you know, and everybody was doing the same, not everybody, but little groups of girls were doing the same thing. So it was kind of fun. Yeah.
I'm definitely going to keep that Jane Asher story in my memory about the sacrifice. I could just imagine that scene at a Catholic high school too, of all things, you know, just.
And the nuns marching and patrolling the lunchtime. It was just so funny. Oh, and it was a good time. We had a good time in those years.
Definitely.
Which is what was life should be like, and high school should be like. And one thing I wanted to bring up is that, you know, everybody said, well, why did the Beatles take off? And I'm sure you've seen this theory. John Kennedy was assassinated in November '63, and it became it was like 9/11. It became a very sad, sad time for the American public, and very dark winter. It was such a dark winter. So when, you know, Ed Sullivan popped up the following February and all this hype about music and stuff, it's just what people needed to get them out of their funk. And especially young teenagers who at home saw so much sadness on TV and from their parents. It just was a time that we needed something.
Absolutely.
To pop,
yeah. You talk about how even like Jackie Kennedy was one of your like idols, and you know, I'm sure millions of girls and even like moms in the world, you know, just loved the Kennedys, and it was such a different and glamorous time really for them. And that was a presidency that I don't think is ever going to happen again. You know, that idea that, you know, they just changed so much. And no, definitely. I think, you know, when the Beatles came, it kind of gave America like a hug, you know, sort of like, it's going to be okay. Yes. You know?
Yeah.
Like things
we
are going to be fine.
We need a little happiness now. We need a little joy. And they were crazy. They were young. They had incredible music from the very beginning. So, and we were just that age where thank God I was 14, you know, because it was just the right age to jump on the bandwagon for Beatlemania.
Definitely.
So,
definitely.
And I mean, there were some older girls. We had one girl who was in one of our extended Beetle Buddy groups. She was like already out of high school, and she was working in an office, and she loved Ringo, and she kind of became, you know, sort of a member of our group, you know, but she she worked. She, you know, she had a career.
Yeah,
she was in an office, but she used to carry a 8x10 picture of Ringo in her handbag. I remember that. And she would wear a St. Christopher medal like Ringo had.
Yeah.
Because that was another thing that I think I brought up, and probably you've heard before, that what your favorite Beatle was, whoever it was, you tried to mimic what he did. And so and Ringo's, it was like my girlfriend would wear a lot of rings, my other girlfriend. And if you were a John fan, of course you had to have a John Lennon cap, you know.
Absolutely.
So it was a mimic, you would mimic them in different ways. So a George fan, my girlfriend was a big George fan. She learned how to play the guitar. Like
George, that's sweet. Yeah.
So she took guitar lessons. So you did take on the attributes of you did take on the attributes of your favorite Beatle, as well as your favorite Beatle girlfriends, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, that's and I guess on to the next question. Why was Paul McCartney your favorite? What about Paul made you just say, oh, I'm a Paul girl through and through?
I think I just, with that first night on Ed Sullivan, I just loved his sort of youthful choir boy look.
Yep.
And his eyes just got me. So and it's been that way for 57 years. It's weird. You know, he's still my favorite. And everybody has a story about why they chose their favorite Beatle that night. And me, it was Paul, and it was his beautiful kind of choir boy looks. And I still see that today, you know. It's just
definitely
amazing.
It's still in him. He's still got sort of like early Beatles, you know.
I watched if you haven't seen it, there was a very good Barnes & Noble interview the other night by the CEO, who's British, of Barnes & Noble, interviewing Paul on his book, Lyrics.
Right.
And if you haven't seen that, it's very good, because Paul actually talks very seriously about the craft of writing. And it's a very nice look at Paul, you know, something different that you haven't seen so much. So
Definitely. I still have to get the book. I have not gotten the book yet, but
I bought it for myself for Christmas, and I hid it now because I won't open it. It's
until
plastic.
Christmas.
Until
nice.
Christmas. Yeah.
Yeah. No, so. I still need to get it. Yeah, it just seems very interesting. Well, that's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, you know, I think the reason I love John so much, I'm a John girl, is I've known about John my whole life, even before I knew the Beatles. You know, John Lennon has, I think, been in our engraved in our history for so long, and I grew up listening to them because my dad would just play the Beatles one over and over and over again. And that was, you know, and I always knew, oh, John Lennon. And I don't know, just for me, it was his humor. I think that's the one thing that always, you know, makes me realize I'm a John girl through and through. Definitely.
His humor was amazing, you know, and he was so special. He was just such an intelligent man, you know, and he had, it's a shame. He did have a hard start in life, you know, with his teenage years and his father and stuff, but a brilliant man and lost way, way too early.
Oh,
you know?
Definitely. Whereas, I mean,
you know,
I just cry at the thought of all the more music we could have had, the more, you know, time that we could have had, you know, with him on the earth. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So I mentioned at the beginning that you were the fan, or you were the president of the Victor Spinetti fan club. So go ahead. Tell me from the beginning, how did this all start?
Okay. Victor was actually coming to Philadelphia in 1964 at the end of September, because he was going to be in a British play called Oh, What a Lovely War, which is a musical. And, we knew about Victor from A Hard Day's Night. And I saw an article in the Philadelphia Bulletin, a small one, that said that Victor Spinetti would be coming in blah, blah. He was in the Beatle movie, and he will be staying at the Bellevue Stratford Hotel. Okay. I wrote a letter to him at the Bellevue Stratford Hotel. Right around the time Well, after the first Beatle concert, it was the middle of September. Lo and behold, I get an answer from him on Bellevue Stratford Stationery. They were starting to do their, they were doing tryouts in Philadelphia for the play before they went to Broadway. And so what we did, he talked about them in this letter, and the letters, the first page is in the book. They photographed it and put it in the book. But we were invited to go down to the stage door of the Forest Theater, where he was going to be in Philadelphia, to meet him. Mm-hmm. And it was not far from our high school, you see. Oh, we were in the center city. So me and my Beatle buddy girlfriends, the four of us, would go down every afternoon after school, carrying our books in our hot uniforms. And Victor would come out. There were other girls there too. We weren't the only ones. There were other girls. And he would come out of the stage door in the afternoon between rehearsal and talk to us.
Wow.
And that's how we met him. Well, we love Victor. I mean, he was so, so sweet to fans, because his idea, which he told me later, is that, Beatle fans became his fans. And,
right.
And that was cool. And that he, this other thing that he told me is that when he was a young man in Wales, that I think he loved Marlene Dietrich, and he said, I know what it feels to long for someone and not ever meet them.
Right.
So he tried very hard to be good to his fans. And through life, he was, not only to our group, but to all groups, to the Beatle Fest groups that he met. And so we decided before he left Philly to go up to New York to for the opening on Broadway, we decided to start a fan club for him.
Wow.
He had already had fan clubs in England, he had one in Brooklyn, and I think he had one in Boston that was opening. But we had the one in Philadelphia, Chapter One, and my girlfriend Diane and I were co-presidents, and the other members of my little Beatle buddy group, the other three, they were the secretary and the treasurer. And it was a small fan club, but the thing that came out of Victor's fan club was a friendship. I was friends with Victor until he died in 2012. And when he was in hospice and in Wales and stuff, I went to see him the last time when he appeared at the Beatle Fest in Las Vegas.
Oh.
I think it was 2006 or 2007. I knew he was getting older. I wanted to see him, and I sat down, and I was with him the whole weekend, and his friend, and I took him out to dinner in Vegas. It was just wonderful to touch base with him, because he's always kept in touch with little notes, or he called me when I was living in Europe. He would call me, and sometimes I'd call him. I asked him questions about my book, because Victor was an author,
right?
And Victor wrote Victor Spinetti, upfront and personal. And actually, he mentions the fan club inside his autobiography. And then on the back cover is this picture of him and John in Help.
Yeah.
And Victor, the quote is, "A Vic," said John, "we rarely impressed with your fan club. Do you think we can join?"
Oh,
that
man.
That's the story behind that, because when they were filming Help in the Bahamas and then in the Alps, we asked Victor, because Victor was in touch with us by mail and also by phone sometimes. We asked Victor if the Beatles would like to be members of his fan club. And he said, yeah, okay, send some membership cards. So we mailed membership cards, and that was what this was all about. He gave them
goodness.
To John and the other guys. So we also... not only were, heard what was going on, so we could put it in our fan club, newsletter when they were on. But the other thing was that Victor was very generous with gifts when he was, on site with them making Help. And the first thing he sent us, believe it or not, this is 50 some years old. This is a menu from the plane that they were on, the Beatles Bahamas special. This is actually, one of them has just gone up in auction 3 years ago, because on the back cover All four autographs.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, if you all can't see, because this will be audio, but it's a brooch, it's a menu from the plane, and it's autographed. Oh my goodness.
And inside, Victor wrote, "For all in Philly, love Victor Spinetti. Oh. At present, working on Beatles 2. That's what they call it.
Beatles 2, yeah.
See back page for autographs of the four lads."
Oh,
and that's what it was.
Gosh.
So this is this, as I said, one just like it that was the plane's captain, the pilot, had been given one, and it went on auction 3 years ago.
Oh my gosh!
So
see, you gotta bring that to the fest if we meet again.
It to the fest is I have a copy, a really good copy.
Okay.
I won't take this out of my safe deposit box.
Sacred,
usually,
of course.
But yeah, I have a perfect copy that I bring to the fest and I show everybody.
Definitely.
So because that wasn't all though, because Victor was such a sweet guy and we loved him so much. And my mother, who was the one, knew Victor too from notes and things, she wrote to Victor while he was, they were in the Alps by that time.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Patty is going to have her 16th birthday soon in a couple of months. Can you send something special for her?"
Oh.
Well, this was, she sent a postcard from the Alps, which is really cute. But on the back, it says, "To Patty from Paul McCartney, happy birthday, love." Well, I almost died.
Oh my gosh.
But it gets better. It gets better.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
I did bring that up, I think, in the book. They also were filming at Twickenham Studios in London, you know, when they were back there, and they had a hairdresser there, and the hairdresser cut Paul McCartney's hair, and this is a lock of my Paul's hair.
You all can't see it, but it's a lock of hair, right, in like a little plastic baggie, and it's Paul McCartney's hair that I'm witnessing right now. That is amazing.
I had slept with this under my pillow for at least 2 years, okay? And I kept looking and saying, is it the same color as mine?
Oh, my goodness.
So we have the same color hair. And I have some funny jokes from friends of mine, like, now you got his hair, you going to clone him?
I mean, you could. That's, definitely.
Yes. So, but anyway, Victor was a good friend of ours. We loved him. He loved us. He was an incredible actor. I mean, people don't know that Victor actually, I mean, he was starred with, he wasn't the star, he was the second banana to Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in The Taming of the Shrew. He was in the Pink Panther movies with Peter Sellers. He was a lot of times the second banana, but he was a very talented stage actor and movie actor.
I get the sense every time I watch, those Beatle films, and I think I actually did remember him being in Taming of the Shrew as well, because I watched that version. But every time I see him, he just cracks me up, and he's such a good actor. Like, it's just one of those things, because he plays such different characters in both of the movies. But, every time, I see him, I just laugh, and I love the way he was, he was in those movies, and he really brought something special to them, I think, because, the Beatles are why you go watch it. But then you realize, oh my gosh, we have a great ensemble of people that are in it as well. So he's wonderful, definitely.
The one fun thing about that is that how he got in the movies, how he got in every beat, he was in the Magical Mystery Tour too, and he was in Help and A Hard Day's Night, because George Harrison's mother liked him as an actor.
I did not know that.
And when they were starting to make movies, Mrs. Harrison said to George, "Well, Victor Spinetti's got to be in that movie and every movie you make."
Wow.
And that's how Victor got in the Beatle movies, because George Harrison's mother thought he was cool and she liked him.
Thank you. So, thank you to Louise, without her.
Yes, Louise. And, it's an interesting thing. And Louise was very good with the fans too. She was very close to fans.
I remember reading that. She was just very sweet and would, be as generous as she could be, which is just wonderful.
Yeah. If you read my friend Pat Mancuso's books, Pat was actually good friends with George's mom and dad and the Harrisons, extended Harrison family. And Pat went over to England and saw them, and because Louise and her husband just love the fans, you know, especially in the very early days.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I always got the sense when just reading any sort of Beatle biography or whatever it is, you know, the Harrisons were so generous with everybody and they just seemed like a really sweet family, which is just, you know, it's so great. And I think that's probably why George is the sweet one, I guess, or the more like quiet one.
But that's
great. And to be able to, you know, congrats to your friend to be able to interact with, you know, Louise Harrison in such a unique, intimate way, you know, you're pretty much talking to the source, you know, at that point. So
that's
amazing.
That's right.
But yeah, you accomplished so much and I applaud you for all of that, you know, because being the Victor Spinetti fan club president, you know, like that's amazing to me. Definitely.
That was fun.
Yeah. I'm going to go back and rewatch Hard Day's Night and Help just to, you know, laugh again because he's great in those movies. He's great.
If you need to laugh, they're good movies to laugh about. And, you know, I've got them on DVDs and it's so much fun to watch them because you have to realize when they came out, those movies came out, the only way we could have seen them was to go to the movies. We had no DVDs.
Right.
We had nothing. I mean, so as long as the Beatle movies were out, we would go back and forth and see them several times. And in those days, what they did was they put out little paperback books, little pocket paperback books, which had all the dialogue in it. Because where could you find that kind of stuff? You know, you didn't have a DVD. You didn't have the internet to open up and say, oh, you know, I can see it on Netflix anytime I want or whatever. So it was a different world, you know, we lived in. And with movies too, we didn't get a chance to see it as much as we wanted to, you know, so we would have been there every day probably.
Definitely. No. So I also wanted to ask, you know, these early days seemed so much fun. And I think the early years of the Beatles was the craziest of the time. But, you know, we get into the later years, the 60s, kind of the beginning of the psychedelic era and, you know, like all that. So what was for you the biggest change in that aspect? Or was it still kind of, you know, the same in a way, but just a little different?
Well, you've got to realize we were growing up. I was 14 when it started. So I was growing up with the Beatles. And by the time they hit just about starting hitting their psychedelic time, 67, I was getting ready to go to college. So it changed for me in many ways. You know, I love them. I wasn't as fond of the psychedelic stuff as I was of the early stuff, although I love a lot of their stuff today. But two, the true story was that I was growing up, you know, and I was getting into a different phase of my life.
Right.
Music was interesting. I can remember the first time I heard Sgt. Pepper's, I was on a date and it was some guy I met in my college. It was college orientation.
Oh, wow.
Weekend or something in Philadelphia. And I was on a date and we were passing one of these head shops. I don't know if you know what a head shop is. No. Do you have any of those?
What is that?
Head shops used to be places you could go to buy blacklight posters. You could buy all kinds of stuff for, you know, if you do grass and that kind of stuff. But there's posters, there's Beatles, there's psychedelic scarves, there was incense, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
they were
called
head shops. And there are some kind of something like that. Some cities have them. But anyway, I was passing a head shop and the door was open. It was summertime. I was on a date and I heard this incredible music and I knew it was the Beatles, but it was the first time I heard, a Magical Mystery Tour. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, so, but it was different. It was different. I still say, you know, even to this day as an old lady, I do still feel more strongly about the early and the middle music than I do with the later music, just because maybe it was my age, you know, that I was growing up and going into different phase of life. Not that I didn't love them desperately, but, you know, when you started college and you started dating and stuff, that you had other things you were thinking about.
Things
that
change.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with you. I think I've always felt way more passionate about those early years. I think just because, I don't know, it was all happening then and it was like the exciting time in the lives. But, but you know, it's, you know, as bands change, you know, times change as well. But that, I mean, yeah, I just think about the incredible changes that happened in those 5 years, 6 years, you know, and it's incredible. So I guess with that, you know, what was the breakup like for you guys in the sense that you grew up with these men, well, and, you know, it all changed?
The thing is, we were kind of back then, because we got our news from the disc jockeys and also from the newspapers. We weren't really sure when they were breaking up, because, you know, you kept hearing like, well, George left the group. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, John thought he wanted to leave the group. And then they're in negotiations with their lawyers and they're going to probably make another album. So it went on for a long while. It dragged on. There was no real definite cutoff date for when they broke up. You know, it was like, okay, they're not making music together. That's sad. But by that time, you know, I was like up to here with college courses. And it wasn't the first, you know, thought in my mind when I got up in the morning anymore. I mean, I love them, but it was a little bit on the side now.
Right,
and of course, I was older and they were breaking up and, oh boy, this is sad. But, you know, yeah, I have other things right now that I'm worrying about. So that's actually how I felt. Now, for other people, I'm sure it was different. But for me, I was just in a different stage and it took so long for them to really break up, you know, formally.
It took so long. Like, you know, the process of it was just so long. But yeah, no, you make a good point, you know, as time changes and you grow up, it's sort of like, you know, my priorities have shifted a little. You know, you still love them, but, you know, it's
I still love them now. I mean, you know, I was in the hospital when I was, you know, giving birth and I was on bed rest from, and I had all my Beatle, you know, music with me and stuff. It's like, it just didn't never went away. It my whole life. And even though there were slumps and there were, you know, mountains and then more slumps, they were always with me through the years. And my girls, when they were little, you know, I'd be picking them up from school, taking them to, you know, theater lessons or wherever. And I'd, you know, put in a CD, and they'd listen to different Beatle albums and other groups too. So they learned all about the 60s and the 70s through mom. You know, they still know this is my thing, and maybe not as big. I think they're bigger Doors fans than they're Beatles fans. I hate to say that, but the house is surrounded by Beatles here, but they laugh and they, you know, they help me with stuff, but they're not as big fan as I am. So
I'd say that's how my family is too. They know I'm the obsessed one, but they love the Beatles too. But maybe not so much my mom. My mom's never really been into the Beatles, which is something that's still a mystery to me to this day. I think it's, I don't know. I think rock in general just isn't her type of music. She's more of like a disco girl, because that was her era, you know? So.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a little bit after our era. The disco came just a little bit after. But, you know, I really love when your generation and even the little ones love the Beatles. I mean, it's just going to live on, you know? I mean, Brian Epstein had said something that in 50 years time, we're still going to be thinking about, well, he was even off because it's gone to 60 years time, you know? But I love when I see people like you at the fest. And I love hearing that it's going down to the next generation, because the music is timeless.
Absolutely.
You know? And the culture of Beatles is timeless too. I mean, it really is. So it's great that I'm so good and glad that, you know, your generation has embraced it. So
we are dedicated and we're just as crazy. I think in a different way though, because now we have so much access, as we've mentioned before, so we can do anything now, really.
It's marvelous. You know, when I first started with this thing in 64, the only thing you can find were cheesy Beatle buttons, you know, and then I got my little Remco dolls, and that kind of stuff. But you couldn't find any, you know, really a lot of Beatles stuff anywhere. Now it's just like, I just, you know, ordered a Beatles spread for my bed and
everything.
And the albums are, you know, endless, and the music is endless. So I'm really happy that it's such a, you know, such a dynamic cultural thing that it's here to stay.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm so thankful to be in like this community of Beatle craziness because because, you know, we get to, we all love the same thing and we're so connected in a way. And I said before, I don't think I would have ever been able to, you know, meet as many people as I do if it weren't for the Beatles, you know, speaking to you at the fest and now, and, you know, like it's incredible really. So I'm so thankful for that now, really.
It's so good though, but people like you promote it and keep it going and you're young and that's what we need because, you know, I say to Pat and Marty, you know, we got to get out there and tell them what the first generation did.
Absolutely.
Or sometimes I call us vintage fans, you know.
Oh yeah.
So what we did because we're passing. We're not going to be here. You know, I'm 72, almost 73. So I'm thinking we got to tell everybody. That's why the books that people like me and Pat and Marty wrote are so important. And our books actually are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Library Archives.
I did not know that. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they ask for them. And we have copies of our books in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because they wanted fan memoirs. So, and we are, another reason why I wrote the book, and of course I had it in my mind all this time, is that I did want the fan experience to be heard, to be read, because at that point when I wrote the book, not too many fans wrote about what they had seen intimately or what they did from day to day. They went to concerts, but what do we do day to day? How we sat in people's bedrooms, how we schemed this and that, how we ran after Victor. It was all part of it. And I wanted the next generations to know that the fans, what the fans actually did and how they did it. So I think that's part of Beatle history. And that to me was important. And that's why one of the reasons why I wrote it. And I think that's one of the reasons why our little group, the three Beatle babes got together, you know, to tell our stories, which is kind of fun.
And definitely. And I think, you know, with my podcast, I try to highlight as many women stories as I can because, you know, especially with the Beatles, because it's so important. And, you know, I do talk about the wives and the girlfriends and, you know, the affairs and all that, but I also just love to talk to, you know, the fans because, you know, while they had male fans, they did, of course, you know, I think just being a girl at that time and being a Beatle fan as a girl is a very powerful thing. Obviously, just talking to you, I can see that. And, you know, it's so important that I highlight yours and, you know, all the other fan stories. And hopefully we can get the Beatle babes on here and we can all talk because it would be such a fun time.
they need about 4 hours because I'm telling you,
we'll do like stories. A bonus episode.
Oh my gosh. Just to hear their stories because, you know, as I said, Pat was very close to George's family and also she saw George a couple times in person, one-on-one. So it's very and very good stories and they were very dedicated fans, both of them, Marty and Pat. So that's why we banded together, you know, and we'll be doing something hopefully at three of us at the fest in Chicago. And I think Pat and I at the fest in New York.
Next spring. I hope if I do go, I get to, you know, see you girls again, you know? Yeah.
Well, Pat and I will be sharing a table. So,
great.
We'll be together and, we'll be in touch anyway, but
definitely
you have to come and spend some time with us and it'll be fun. Maybe you can do a live broadcast or something.
I would love that. That would be great. Oh my gosh.
They're going to have some great, great guests. I mean, they're going to have Billy J. Kramer there. They're going to have a lot of people are going to be there. So, and it's the first one in 2 years.
Billy's very nice. He's gone on my Instagram and messaged me just because he and Cynthia were very good friends back in the day. And he has very fond memories of her and very sweet guy.
He's a very, very sweet guy. And he's just gone through a hard time. He just lost his wife.
But
he's a very sweet guy. He's going to be one of the headliners at the fest next year.
Oh yeah.
And that's April 1st, 2nd and 3rd. And we're all getting ready for it,
definitely,
you know, because it's been so long because of COVID, they kept postponing it, you know,
I know.
So, but I have my Beetle masks I can wear.
Oh, yay.
Wear masks.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All thing Beetle. But actually, the thing is with the younger generation and people like you going to places like the Fest, it's a good chance to see the first generation fans in person and hear our stories and get to see us on the panels because we're, you know, on the panels too. And we're, you know, as one of my friends said who works with the Fest, he said, oh, we're really going to be happy to hear you and Pat because so many of us for first generation Beatle people have died during the last couple of years.
Right.
That's very sad. And that made me feel sad because I've seen some news going on and I'm thinking, yeah, you know, we're getting scares.
I know. So, yeah. It's scary. Like, it's scary to think about. I think that's why it's so important that, you know, you guys have written books and kept this history because it's kind of going away, even though I hate saying it, but it's very true.
It's true. You know, I mean, I take my vitamins, you know, the gym is very important, but you know, it's just that you feel like it was a time and a place that won't come again.
Right.
And if you can talk about it to younger people and kind of impart that, you know, and also from the book, it, you know, the book is it's been important for me and has a lot of information about what it was like to be 14.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I wrote it when I did, because now I go back and I said, did that happen? I forget, you know, cause it took me a while to write the book. And then I remembered a lot of stuff from up here. I mean, this wasn't all from the diary, you know, it was from my brain
too. Up in the brain,
Yeah, I had to remember all this stuff. And, you know, it was a really good part. You know, that, as I said, the disc jockeys too played a big part in those days. And in the back of my book, I decided I had a very freaky kind of format for the book. In fact, Larry Kane, who's written some Beatle books.
Yes.
Good old Larry.
Good old Larry.
He was a commentator in Philadelphia. He did the news. So I knew of him, and I had him write my foreword, you know. So when he read my manuscript, the first thing that came to his mind, because he's a writer, is that's a very strange format you have in the book with a diary and then two interviews in the back. He said, you know, and he said, yeah, you're right, Larry. He says, you know, that's not nonfiction. You know, I said, no, I know, but you got to realize this is a book written from a 14-year-old's perspective.
Absolutely.
So it's different. And I needed to put those interviews in the back because one interview, I interviewed Victor in Las Vegas in 2006 or 7. And I wanted to interview him because I needed that for the book. And then the other one was with that famous disc jockey in Philadelphia, High Lit. And I had interviewed him in 1965 for my little column. And then again in 2007 before he died.
That's amazing.
So that's in the book too. So
yeah, definitely.
So it's just kind of a chronicle of life back then.
Definitely. Yep. It's an enjoyable read and I highly recommend everybody pick it up. You can go on our website, get it. I'm sure it's on Amazon as well. I'm not sure, but
it's on Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Diary of a Beatle Maniac. Or if you want to get an autograph copy, you can go on my website, which is all together Diary of a Beatle Maniac.com.
Yes. So,
and then I can get back to you about autograph copies.
Definitely. Yeah. So get a copy, everybody, because it's an enjoyable read.
Oh, and my publisher has copies. I actually got it published through a bona fide publisher.
Wow.
Not self-publishing. Outside, it's in Malvern, PA, near Philadelphia, a company called Cynren Press, C-Y-N-R-E-N. Okay. They're very nice and they can help you too if you need a copy.
So, oh, definitely. Yeah. Everybody go read it. Go, you know, see what it was like to be the first generation of fans, because, you know, I'm sure we all would have loved it.
You carry it on. Yes. And that's the important part. It's great to be first generation, but we need you to to carry it on.
We'll carry the torch. We will keep going.
Carry the torch for us. You know,
we'll keep going. I thought of this as I was like thinking about it, but I just a side note, wouldn't this be a great movie? I mean, maybe not your story, but just in general, like, you know, someone's story. It would be such a funny movie, I think.
My idea was, there was a movie that came out. What was it called? It was back in the 70s.
I Want to Hold Your Hand. Is that what?
Yeah. And it was about the fans. And when I started writing this book, that was in the back of my mind that this would make a good, you know, it would make a good movie about fandom. I mean,
absolutely.
Nothing's been made about fandom since, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand. So, yeah. And the fans are an important part of this whole story.
That's one of my favorite movies ever. I just rack up. I mean,
And it's true. I mean, so much of it was true, yeah, you know, the way we hung around and outside of here and there. And I mean, I hung around, it wasn't only the Beatles. I mean, it was like the Dave Clark Five came to town and I pushed my way into a press conference there. And I mean, you know, there were so many different stories about fans, you know. I mean, it wasn't just Beatle fans, you know.
There were it was fans.
All kinds
of
fans.
Absolutely.
But it would make a fun movie.
I think it would be hilarious. Yeah. It would be just great. And it would be a different angle because, you know, we get a lot of like Beatle movie-esque, you know, whatever, but it would be such a good angle, I think. I'm always thinking about that.
It would be. I put my feelers out once in a while to people who are in the business, you know, it'd be fun, but you know, it's a, because here you got a 14-year-old girl, braces, white glasses, pimples, you know. I mean, that was me, okay? You know, it took a while for all that stuff to go away. And I just was deathly in love with Paul McCartney, you know. I mean, who would have thought, you know? And it would make a fun thing because it's a coming of age kind of.
Definitely. Book.
So it would be a coming of age kind of movie if that's anything, you know. Worth anything these days, I don't know.
They definitely are. And I think the coming of age story itself has been done a lot, but this is, like I said, a unique angle because it's with a band that we all love and know, you know. So I think it would be so funny.
And as I said, the Beatles just keep getting hotter. I mean, you know, all the things that Paul and Ringo do today and the books and the movies and the documentaries and, you know, new remastered music. It's it doesn't go away. I'm happy about that. I mean, I could have picked a band that fell into oblivion, you know. I didn't. I picked the Beatles. So
thank goodness you did. Yeah. Could have just been Herman and the Hermits and that would have been it. But
Well, he's still on tour all the time.
They're still going. They're still going. Yeah.
You know, it's a and the sad part of it today, because as I've mentioned a few times, we're getting older. In the first generation, you know, every time you open up the internet and you see somebody went, some guitarist or some, you know, we're getting fewer and fewer, you know, even the entertainers. I mean, even for Beatle Fest, I mean, years ago, there was more of a pool to pick from. And
now there's not.
Smaller. Yeah. It's getting smaller. Or those, some people retire too, you know, some of the musicians, they don't go around at 85, you know, so. It's good to talk about it and it's still hot. It's
definitely. Good. Well, I wanted to thank you so much for coming on here today. I mean, this has been so much fun and it's been an honor, really.
Oh, thank you. You're so welcome. I've enjoyed this so much. It's been so much fun too. And as I said, I love when the younger generation like you just get on the bandwagon, you know, to promote it and keep it going because, you know, the next generation is so important for this. You know?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. You brought back a lot of memories for me today too.
So everybody go ahead and go get Diary of a Beatlemaniac. It's available online on Pat's website. You can get autographed copies and just, you know, have a great time reading about, you know, Beatle craziness and what it was like back then. Thank you so much. And I will see you all on the next wonderful episode of the She Loves You podcast. Thanks. Bye-bye, guys.